Good morning. The country's most senior defense officials shared details of a strike in Yemen on a private messaging app. How'd that happen? Is that an example of a lack of experience in this administration? It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Russia stands to gain a lot from a closer relationship with the U.S., more trade to help its economy, more influence around the world. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadel. But are there ways in which the U.S. would benefit as well? Also, how the U.S. looks to an interested outsider in China, and a New Year's celebration in Syria after years of repression. It's Tuesday, March 25th. 30 years ago today, WikiWikiWeb launched. Wiki, the Hawaiian word for quick, now also means websites that are edited by users. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The White House National Security Council says a group of top-secret text messages among senior Trump administration officials appears to be authentic, and it's reviewing this. A reporter was inadvertently invited into the chat. He says the chat covered explicit details about a pending U.S. attack in Yemen. Democrats, such as California Representative Sarah Jacobs, want a congressional investigation.
I think there needs to be real consequences because this has real implications for the security of our service members.
But House Speaker Mike Johnson is less worried.
The administration is addressing what happened. Apparently, an inadvertent phone number made it onto that thread. They're going to track that down and make sure that it doesn't happen again. What you did see, though, I think, was top-level officials doing their job, doing it well.
But the explicit details involving names and locations of U.S. service personnel were apparently shared on devices that could be hacked by anyone. Some of the people on that text chain reportedly included the Director of National Intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard, and CIA Director John Ratcliffe. Both are supposed to appear today at a pre-scheduled hearing before the Senate Intelligence Committee. President Trump's nominee to lead the Social Security Administration faces a Senate confirmation hearing today. NPR's Windsor Johnston has more.
Global tech firm executive Frank Bisignano will go before the Senate Finance Committee. Lawmakers are expected to question him about the Trump administration's decision to slash thousands of jobs at the agency and close several field offices. The cutbacks have led to difficulties for beneficiaries trying to access services, including longer wait times for phone calls, with many being disconnected. Starting next Monday, millions of Americans will not be able to verify their identity over the phone, creating challenges for older adults who may have limited access to online services or can't visit a Social Security office in person. Windsor Johnston, NPR News, Washington.
The wife of Vice President Vance is poised to visit Greenland this week, along with Trump administration officials. The visit carries significance. NPR's Deepa Shivaram reports President Trump has repeatedly suggested the U.S. should take over Greenland, a territory controlled by Denmark.
Trump says the visit from Mrs. Vance and National Security Advisor Mike Waltz is not a provocation and that the visit is purely friendly. But he repeated his claim that Greenland is interested in being, quote, taken care of by the U.S.
I think Greenland's going to be something that maybe is in our future. I think it's important. It's important from the standpoint of international security.
Vance, along with one of her sons, is attending cultural events in Greenland, including the national dog sledding race. Waltz, for his part, will visit a U.S. military base. Deepa Shivaram, NPR News.
You're listening to NPR. President Trump is nominating the acting director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention for the job permanently. Susan Manares has previously worked in leadership at the Federal Advanced Research Projects Agency for Health. She holds a PhD, not a medical degree. Manares will now face a Senate confirmation hearing. In women's NCAA college basketball, the Sweet 16 teams are set, but the tournament was overshadowed last night when one of college basketball's biggest stars suffered an injury. Greg Eklund explains.
Southern California sophomore Juju Watkins, a first-team All-American and this season's Big Ten Player of the Year, had to be carried off the floor in the first quarter of the Trojans' second-round game against Mississippi State. Watkins was grabbing her right knee when she was down, which stirred up a reaction from her coach, Lindsey Gottlieb.
I mean, I'd be lying if I told you that I wasn't rattled, you know, seeing Juju on the floor and crying. I mean, this is a human game.
Despite what the team describes as a season-ending injury to Watkins, USC rallied to build its lead and easily handled Mississippi State 96-59. For NPR News, I'm Greg Eklund.
A court in Japan has ordered the Unification Church to be dissolved in that country. This is part of an investigation that began with the 2022 assassination of former Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. An investigation into his slaying revealed close ties between the church and some Japanese lawmakers. The Unification Church says it will appeal immediately. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org. And Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota History in 90 Seconds.
1962. Minoru Yamasaki was only one of 39 candidates. Northwestern National Life Insurance had outgrown its building on Minneapolis's Loring Park, and it had gotten a deal on some land in the city's Gateway District, the area that was chock-a-block with deteriorating buildings and flop houses, which Minneapolis was busily tearing down. So it had put out a call for architects. Yamasaki, a Detroit architect, was on a run of good and bad luck. The good was that he'd been tapped to build the World Trade Center towers in New York. The bad, the digestive issues for which he'd had part of his stomach removed, and he'd recently gotten divorced and remarried, and this new marriage was heading for divorce too. But he took the Minneapolis job, and even while he negotiated the Trade Center towers, he created a modernist gem for Minneapolis, an elegant temple circled by tapering concrete pillars, the Northwestern National Life Insurance, later the Voya Financial Building, which opened at the north end of Nicollet Mall in 1965.
MN90 is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Online at mn90.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. In a few minutes, we will ask whether Russia and the U.S. would benefit from closer ties, and if so, how. But first,
in an extraordinary security breach, the country's most senior security officials created a group chat on a messaging app to discuss U.S. airstrikes on Yemen.
Now, two important points about this. First, the group chat was on that commercial messaging app, Signal, not a secure U.S. government network. And second, the group included a journalist, Jeffrey Goldberg, editor of The Atlantic magazine, apparently by accident.
For more, we're joined by NPR national security correspondent Greg Myrie. Hey, Greg.
Good morning, Layla.
Okay, so, I mean, how did this happen?
Well, the editor of The Atlantic, Jeffrey Goldberg, said he got a notice on the messaging app Signal on March 11th, inviting him to join a group chat regarding the Houthis in Yemen. Now, the invitation came from the National Security Advisor, Mike Waltz, and included all the top national security officials, including Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth. Now, Goldberg initially thought this was some sort of hoax. Someone was trying to entrap him. But over the next few days, the text increasingly looked to be genuine, with details about U.S. plans to bomb the Houthis in Yemen. Goldberg spoke to All Things Considered yesterday about what then happened on March 15th.
I'm sitting in my car in a parking lot in a supermarket at 11:44 a.m. Eastern, and I get this war plan from Pete Hegseth.
And so 2 hours later, the U.S. bombing begins in Yemen, and Goldberg realizes this is no hoax. These U.S. airstrikes are real, and they're still ongoing. And Hegseth yesterday questioned the credibility of Goldberg, but the National Security Council put out a statement saying the material appeared to be authentic.
I mean, it's pretty remarkable. And Democrats have been highly critical of Trump's national security team, saying it lacked experience. Is this an example of that supposed lack of experience?
Well, Layla, certainly seems so, and they certainly should have known better. Hegseth often talks about his military experience, as does Waltz, and rest assured they were never told as soldiers to share military operations, in advance on their preferred messaging app and to include emojis, as Waltz apparently did with a clenched fist, a flag, and a fire emoji. And this group also included the nation's top two intelligence officials, CIA Director John Ratcliffe and Director of National Intelligence Tulsi Gabbard. Now, those agencies are absolutely fanatical about secure communications, yet based on Goldberg's account, no senior national security official raised concerns about sharing war plans on Signal.
And how do national security officials normally communicate when discussing sensitive military operations?
Well, those officials are supposed to use a SCIF, which stands for Sensitive Compartmented Information Facility. These secure rooms are built to discuss classified information. You can't take a phone into these rooms. You can't take documents out. And all of these top-ranking national security officials have SCIFs at their offices and at their homes.
I mean, makes sense in principle, but how does it work in reality? Senior national security officials are often traveling for work. Their job doesn't end when the weekend comes. Is this practical?
Well, it can be very impractical, but that's how it's supposed to be done. These airstrikes against the Houthis in Yemen began on a Saturday afternoon, so officials may not have been near a SCIF, but it doesn't mean they should be discussing the launch of a major U.S. military operation in real time on their phones, on a commercial messaging app.
NPR's Greg Myrie. Thank you, Greg.
Sure thing, Layla.
In its first months in office, the Trump administration is breaking with decades of U.S. policy toward Russia. The president and other members of his administration have talked about economic and geopolitical deals and opportunities in Russia. So what does Russia want out of this relationship? And is there anything the U.S. could gain? For some answers, we've called Elena Rybakova. She is a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics, that's here in Washington, D.C., and it's a nonpartisan think tank focused on strategies for global economic development. Good morning, Ms. Rybakova. Thanks so much for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So how would you characterize the economic relationship between the U.S. and Russia now?
Well, it is a very harsh reality of almost no relationship. The trade between Russia at the moment is about $3.5 billion per year. It is a tiny amount. It used to be closer to 20, and Russia used to have a deficit, by the way, in terms of trade with the U.S. But the relationship is very difficult. However, we have seen the current administration wants to have a restart. It is not the first restart between the U.S. and Russia in terms of warming up of the relationship.
So what would it mean for Russia if it could trade more with the U.S.?
For Russia, the most significant objective is to have the approval of the United States for it to do what it needs to do in its sphere of influence. Russia wants to be acknowledged by the U.S. as a global power in this multipolar world. And the most significant economic benefit it could get is to have sanctions lifted. And that's what we have seen Russia lobby heavily already with the current administration.
So that would not mean more trade with the U.S. It would likely mean more trade with Europe and other parts of the world. Is that right?
Absolutely, you're going straight to the point. For Russia, Europe is used to be the most important partner, and Russia exports, let's not forget, mostly natural resources. 60% of Russia's exports is oil and gas, and then another 25 or so metals and mining and other natural resources, basically almost entirely natural resources. And a big chunk of that it used to send to Europe, particularly energy. Europe bought more than 40% of Russia's energy. While for oil, Russia could divert away to China and India after the war started, this time around was Ukraine. But for gas, it is struggling. You need to have a very expensive pipeline, and China is not interested in financing it. So yes, for Russia, most importantly, it's to regain the relationship with Europe. And it's hoping that the U.S. will help push down on Europe in a way to restart the relationship, or at very least will lift sanctions, which will allow Russia to restart that relationship.
So I do want to get to the sort of the broader geopolitical question, but just if I could just ask you about the sort of the narrow question, because this administration seems very focused on that. Is there a specific U.S. economic interest in normalizing or at least warming relationships with Russia?
Narrowly focused on macroeconomics, I fail to see that because the trade used to be very small. It used to be always in deficit and was noticed. This current administration is not happy about countries with trade deficits with the U.S. Russia exported some commodities to the U.S., oil products, especially when there were issues, say, with Venezuela. But then it's imported most of everything else. Maybe it will be car imports, semiconductors, you know, and other any more complicated products. So it's hard to see what would be specific macroeconomic benefit for the U.S.
So what would be the benefit to the U.S.? Because it seems very clear that this administration, at least President Trump in particular, seems to have a keen desire to normalize relations with Russia. So what would be the benefit?
Judging from the statement from the administration, I think the key benefit they see, it would allow President Trump to have the deal where there would be either ceasefire or maybe hopefully more permanent truce or peace deal in Ukraine. So that to me seems to be more broader geopolitical objective rather than any specific macroeconomic benefit to the U.S. from trade with relatively small country, especially when U.S. is actually also an oil producer, and not only a producer, and also potentially an expert of oil and gas. Let's not forget that U.S. and Russia are in direct competition in terms of selling, for example, LNG to Europe.
Exactly. So before we let you go, we only have a couple of seconds left here. So I am curious about what you see as the opportunity for warming. What might we be looking for to see whether there is actual progress here? As you mentioned earlier at the beginning of our conversation, there have been numerous kind of resets and setbacks in this relationship over the last decades. So what might we be looking for to see if there's an actual change?
I would see what Russia has to gain from it. Russia wants to have sanctions lifted. So if we hear anything about the financial sanctions being lifted or the threat of secondary sanctions being removed, I think that is the key indicator. I think the truth is unlikely to happen soon.
That is Alina Rybakova. She's a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. That's a nonpartisan think tank here in Washington, D.C. Ms. Rybakova, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Texas is moving closer to requiring the Ten Commandments in public schools and allowing for school prayer. Other states are considering similar bills after a 2022 Supreme Court ruling that appeared to allow for more religion in public schools. Houston Public Media's Andrew Schneider reports.
Early last week, the Texas State Senate passed a bill to allow for prayer and Bible readings in public schools. The next day, it passed another bill to require every public school classroom in the state to display the Ten Commandments.
Our kids are crying out for moral clarity, crying out for it.
Republican State Senator Phil King, who represents a district west of Fort Worth, authored the Ten Commandments bill.
And I think it's so important for them to walk in and see something that has been part of our tradition and been part of our history for as far back as they'll read, almost as far back as they'll read in studying world history.
Democratic State Senator Sarah Eckhart of Austin called the bill unconstitutional.
Politics masquerading as faith is the evil the separation between church and state is designed to prevent. To ensure religious freedom for all, we must never establish a state-sanctioned religion. And that is what this bill does.
A Louisiana Ten Commandments law passed last year has been temporarily blocked by a federal judge over its constitutionality. Over a dozen states are considering bills this year, but some have stalled so far in Montana, Georgia, and the Dakotas. Some lawmakers were concerned about potential court challenges. But support among Texas lawmakers for these bills seems strong. Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick, a Republican, made his stance clear while welcoming the Senate's Chaplain of the Day.
Yesterday, we passed a bill on this floor, bipartisan, to put prayer back in public school. And later today, we will pass a bill to put the Ten Commandments in our schools. Thank you for a lifetime of serving the Lord. This is a Christ-centered legislative body.
Democratic senators argue that there are at least hundreds of thousands of Texans who don't consider themselves Christian. But amendments to post sacred texts of other faiths in public schools failed.
That was Andrew Schneider, and this is NPR News.
Thank you.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizewitz, and this is Climate Connections. When the Stone Canyon fire raged near Lyons, Colorado last year, Nick Schneider and his wife saw most of their property go up in flames. But the couple's home itself was spared, thanks to efforts they had taken to prevent fires from reaching the house.
There was a pretty clear line, and everything outside that line was totally burned. And then there was a zone where, by design, the fire ran out of fuel.
Just months before the fire, the couple had contacted a group called Wildfire Partners, which helps Colorado homeowners prepare for wildfires. Schneider says the organization sent an expert to inspect their property and worked with them to identify steps they could take to help protect their home. Their plan included trimming tall grass and bushes that would fuel a fire, installing ground cover like stone and gravel, and moving flammable items like firewood away from the house. Schneider says those efforts paid off.
I'm 100% sure that if we had not made those steps with Wildfire Partners, that our house would have burned down.
As the climate warms, the risk of wildfires is growing. But as Schneider's experience shows, people can take action to help protect their homes. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Proven Winners, with Proven Winners Color Choice Shrubs, offering flowering shrubs and evergreens selected for home landscapes. More at provenwinnerscolorchoice.com/NPR. From Arm, committed to delivering innovative, advanced computing designed to enable worldwide companies to unleash the capabilities and experiences of AI. The future of AI is built on Arm. Arm.com. From Fisher Investments, as a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep in Beijing. In China last year, we met a Chinese scholar who studies the United States. Da Wei developed some ideas of why America has succeeded as a country.
Obviously, U.S. have a quite matured political system, which ran for more than 200 years.
The Chinese scholar said the U.S. gained from a stable political system, strong regulations, lots of immigrants. Since we spoke last year, a new U.S. administration has taken office, so we met Da Wei again this week. And it was a chance to see how America looks to an outsider. He said to meet us at a tea house.
Yeah, good to see you.
Yeah,
again.
Good to see you. Thank you for coming over.
Thank you.
He rushed in wearing a blue blazer, dressed to teach a class that day at Tsinghua University.
What kind of tea did we order?
Green tea, Dragon Well
tea, which is best when harvested before April 5th.
Anyway, the tea after that, after April 5th, will be less expensive.
So this is prime tea season.
Yeah, exactly.
The server poured into tiny cups. I just want to say, this looks like just hot water almost,
but
there's so much flavor to it.
Yeah, so if you make it at home, you put the tea leaves in this kind of a glass, you can see the tea leaves, you know.
Yeah, they float up.
Yeah, flow up and down, so it's beautiful.
Mm.
It's kind of philosophical, I will say. You can try to read the tea leaves.
He tried to read the tea leaves about the United States. He's followed the Trump administration's firing of federal workers and dismantling of some agencies. He's traveled often to Washington and knows many people there.
I live in the think tank world and also government world. Some of them left their office or lost their job.
Oh, you know people who've been fired
in the United States?
Yeah, okay.
And from this personal level, I feel sad or bad about what is happening in the United States. Having said that, I don't want to be too critical to Trump administration, just from this personal level. As a scholar, I try to be neutral. I think there is something big happening in the U.S. It could be bad, it could be good.
He says modern forms of government rose with the Industrial Revolution. Now technology is changing, and government may change too. This is what he thinks about when watching a billionaire tech bro promising to move fast and break things alongside a president who seems to make hourly pronouncements on social media.
So I will say this is very revolutionary.
Dawei says some of his American friends compare this to a different revolution, China's cultural revolution in the 1960s and 70s.
Cultural revolution is basically the most chaotic period of modern China history.
China's leader, Mao Zedong, encouraged supporters to root out elites and intellectuals suspected of being a kind of deep state. Radical groups harassed or attacked people at businesses and universities.
That's organized and mobilized by Chairman Mao himself and also his political allies.
I just want to say this out loud. There's a charismatic leader who, for his own purposes, gets ordinary people to get out there and attack the intellectuals and the elites.
Smash the establishment.
And the universities.
Government officials.
And supposed closet capitalists in this communist society.
But I have to say, what is happening in the U.S. is still far from the Cultural Revolution. It's maybe 1 or 2% of the... But you can sense that smell, the populist sentiments, you know. Basically, everything the people have correct, common sense is good. So those sophisticated thoughts are something bad.
In the Cultural Revolution, universities were shut down, the professors sent to work in the fields, and business owners were forced to surrender their homes. Dawei says he doesn't want to take this analogy too far.
I'm still confident to some institutions and the laws, rule of law of the U.S., so I don't think the situation could become so bad, but a chaotic populist political movement, I think, it's alike.
And Dawei says Trump's movement has devastated parts of the U.S. government that gave the U.S. an advantage in its competition with his country, China. The administration moved to shut down Voice of America and other broadcasters like Radio Free Asia.
So the first reaction was, oh, it's so sad, because when we were in college, we learned English through Voice of America. Voice of America have a special English program. It spoke very slowly.
They were famous for this.
So we learn English through that. I still remember, you know, when I was a freshman in college, for the first time I listened to the Voice of America special English.
He says he heard news that Chinese media didn't cover. Dawei acknowledges that in recent years, VOA was less important as the internet spread. But he says another agency mattered more, the foreign aid agency USAID, which spread American influence in the developing world.
I think it's important, and also it's part of so-called competition between China and the U.S.
I'm thinking of a soccer term, own goal, where you score for the other team accidentally. are foreign policy specialists here looking at the Trump administration moves as an own goal?
You can say that. To be honest, I think the majority view here is this is in China's interest.
He says it would also be in China's interest for the U.S. to lose its alliances with European nations or South Korea or Japan.
The alliances of the U.S. is, we believe also, it's a important source, one of the most important sources of the U.S. strength.
I noticed a news item in the South China Morning Post, a famous newspaper out of Hong Kong, and they noted that the Chinese government, the foreign minister, in recent days had a meeting with officials from Japan and South Korea, longtime U.S. allies, and said, in this time of chaos, you, U.S. allies, need to be closer with us, China.
Yes, I think I don't want to give our listener an impression that China tried to, you know, drag away U.S. allies. For China, it's a long time goal to have good relations with Japan and Korea. These two countries are our neighbors and also very, you know, important economies.
China would want that regardless.
Of course. You can say China is utilizing this opportunity. You can also say China just doing what China has done in past 2 decades, but now with smaller resistance. This is what is happening here.
Dawei, the Chinese scholar, finished his tea and hurried off to teach his class. He'd offered a view of the news from the United States as it looks from a Beijing tea house. This is NPR News.
The threat of a massive earthquake hangs over the Pacific Northwest, and no one knows when it could strike. For instance, you could be massively pregnant and crib shopping at IKEA.
I wrote this book because I was starting to crack, living with the fear of this.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. The debut novel, Tilt, by author Emma Patti, on All Things Considered from NPR News.
You can hear All Things Considered. It's coming up this afternoon at 4 o'clock here on KAXE. I'm Heidi Holton. Thanks for tuning in. It is the Tuesday morning show. It's 5:29. Coming up, more news from National Public Radio. Before that, we get our daily dose of phonology with John Latimer. Lots of student reports to bring to you today. What's better than learning about spring from people much, much younger than us? It's great to listen to. And our question of the week this week, what signs of spring are you seeing? Or what are you looking forward to? You can text us at 218-326-1234. The annual Record Store Day Sale is coming up for KEXE and KBXE. It's Saturday, April 12th from 9 to 1 at Rail River Folk School in Bemidji. Dig through the crates with us and find new old gems for your collection. We are still accepting Gently Loved vinyl donations through March 28th. Drop off at our studios in Grand Rapids or Bemidji during business hours. You can help us out with our April fundraiser coming up. We want to know why you listen to KEXE. Text us 218-326-1234, or you can leave a voicemail for Heather. Lots of things going on in our region, and that includes tomorrow at 1 p.m., the Bemidji Senior Center has a program about dementia. Learn how the disease affects people and how you can make a difference in the lives of those living with it. And Project Read is accepting gently used children's books at the Community Education Service Center in the former Southwest Elementary Building in Grand Rapids. Weather around the region, mostly sunny today with highs 40 to 46, overnight lows in the mid-20s. Tomorrow looking like partly sunny skies with 43 to 48 degrees. If you love KEXE and maybe you work in a business in northern Minnesota, you can help support KEXE by becoming a business sponsor. You can find out more by emailing sponsors at kaxe.org. Time now for John Latimer. It's our daily dose of phonology.
On today's date, March 25th in the year 2000, I find my first blue-spotted salamander of the year. The salamanders have spent the winter in the leaf litter, maybe under a log somewhere, staying unfrozen, and now they are getting out and moving about. Their goal this time of year is to find a nearby vernal pond, one of those places that will hold water until at least midsummer, because once the salamanders wake up, as this one has, they will find a mate and copulate, and ultimately the female will begin laying eggs on debris around the edges of these vernal ponds, probably 10 to 12 eggs at a spot, and then maybe 500 eggs total. The babies will hatch about a month later. They'll have well-developed eyes and mouths, and after about a week, their front legs will begin to develop. Oddly enough, if you check out a blue-spotted salamander close distance, you'll see that they have four toes on their front legs and five toes on their back legs. Enjoy them and keep those vernal ponds clean, because that is exceptionally important to the life of the salamander.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Bank of America. From local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadel. Good morning. A federal appeals court in Washington, D.C. is weighing whether to allow the White House to quickly deport alleged members of a Venezuelan gang under a rarely used wartime authority.
It is the latest episode in a broader legal debate about the Alien Enemies Act. And last night, the Trump administration said it is invoking the state secrets privilege in a standoff with another federal judge over deportation flights that may have defied his orders.
NPR's Joel Rose has been following that debate, and he joins us now. Good morning, Joel.
Hey, Leila.
Okay, so this case has been moving pretty quickly. Remind us, what was the appeals court considering at the hearing Monday?
This is a three-judge panel from the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, and it was hearing an appeal from the Trump administration of a lower court's ruling. The district court judge in that case has temporarily blocked the administration from deporting anyone under the Alien Enemies Act, which has only been used three times in U.S. history, all when the country was actively at war. The Trump administration argues it should apply here as well because of the threat posed by the Venezuelan gang Tren de Aragua, which the administration has designated as a foreign terrorist organization. In an order yesterday, the judge reaffirmed his temporary restraining order on the grounds that these Venezuelan migrants have not gotten due process, had no meaningful chance to argue that they are not members of this notorious gang.
And what happened in the appeals court hearing Monday?
One appeals court judge in particular seemed also very concerned about these due process questions. Judge Patricia Millett, who was appointed by Barack Obama, this law was used most recently during World War II, and even then, Millett said, detained Germans had a chance to fight their deportations, unlike these Venezuelans today.
There were plane loads of people. There were no procedures in place to notify people. Nazis got better treatment under the Alien Enemy Act than has happened here.
You know, the Justice Department's lawyer disputed the Nazi analogy and said that some of these Venezuelan men have, in fact, been able to fight their removal. But Judge Millett questioned whether the other 200 migrants who were deported had any chance to do that. She said, we don't have any record of whether these people were gang members or victims of the gang. The White House says it is confident that all of those deported are violent gang members, but the administration has also conceded in legal filings that many do not have criminal records in the U.S. Immigrant advocates contend many are actually not gang members at all, but have been targeted because they have tattoos.
The administration has been firm in saying they have the authority to invoke this act. What was the case they made in court?
The Justice Department's lawyer argued that the district court judge overstepped by inserting the court into foreign policy and never should have issued his order in the first place. Here's Drew Ensign from the Justice Department.
The district court's order represents an unprecedented and enormous intrusion upon the powers of the executive branch and in a manner that could intrude upon sensitive diplomatic negotiations.
Ensign also spent a lot of time arguing that immigrant advocates brought basically the wrong kind of lawsuit and should have challenged the individual cases in Texas where these deportation flights originated. We don't know when this panel will rule, but it could be soon.
And at the same time, the Trump administration is fighting to avoid releasing more details about these deportation flights. Where does that stand?
Yeah, on a separate legal track, the Trump administration has told U.S. District Judge James Boasberg last night that it is invoking the state secrets privilege and will continue to not give him key information about those flights, including departure times and other operational details. Boasberg has been pushing the administration to explain whether it defied his orders when it allowed deportation flights to continue last weekend. He has said in court that he will get to the bottom of whether his order was violated.
NPR's Joel Rose. Thank you, Joel.
You're welcome.
Millions around the world are celebrating Nowruz this week. It's a 13-day secular festival, sometimes called Persian New Year. In Syria, it's celebrated mostly by Kurdish people. Many did so in secret until the Assad regime fell in December. Now they're throwing their biggest Nowruz party in decades. And here's Lauren Freyer takes us there.
The traffic on the road to this lake in northern Syria stretches for miles. And then when you get to this turquoise lake surrounded by sort of arid hills, there are people doing conga lines, drum circles, and people playing wooden flutes.
These revelers are Kurdish. They make up about 10% of Syria and live mostly in this northern region, which saw some of the fiercest battles and mass killings of the civil war. Many residents of this city of Afrin fled north to Turkey or east to the protection of Kurdish militias or even to Europe. Shayar Hassan fled to Germany. but he's now come home.
When I was coming and I was on the road, I was taking a video and, you know, my eyes were tearing and it's talking about 12 years that I haven't been here.
There's one thing, though, that he can't get used to. The presence in the crowd here of Syrian government security forces protecting Kurdish people. This month, the new government signed a peace deal with the biggest Kurdish militia to try to form one united Syrian army. That would have been unthinkable under ex-President Bashar al-Assad, he says.
At the time of Bashar al-Assad, we're coming to celebrate Nowruz and security forces, we would feel terrified. And now it's completely different, so it's very nice.
On Nowruz, people picnic in nature. They cut flowers, light bonfires. Hora Osman is a local Kurdish politician who organized this lakeside gathering. He grew up during the presidency of Bashar's father, Hafez al-Assad, and he remembers being beaten in school for celebrating Nowruz. But it got worse, he says, when hardline Islamist groups took control of this region during Syria's civil war. Some of them considered Nowruz pagan, and they killed four people for celebrating nearby 2 years ago. Those groups are loosely affiliated with the Sunni Arab fighters who now govern Syria. And so Osman says he worries that Syria's new rulers might not always keep their hardline allies in check. Those same groups have been blamed for the killings of other minorities, Alawites, on Syria's coast in recent weeks. Even in grief, you can celebrate just this one happy day, says Siham Alu, a mother of nine children and what she says are too many grandchildren to count. One of them, a little boy, clings to her skirt as Alu describes how decades of repression and conflict have changed her. She says 20 years ago she felt Syrian and Kurdish, but now she's Kurdish first. Lots of other people at this Nowruz celebration say they feel both. But Alu poses a challenge for Syria's new rulers. On top of rebuilding this country and preventing violence from armed groups that are still here, they'll also need to convince this mother of nine to embrace, once again, her Syrian identity. Lauren Freyer, NPR News in Afrin, Syria.
This is NPR News.
At KAXE, we are excited to announce new programs coming to the airwaves in 2025, like Minnesota Mixtape, Fridays at 10 a.m. and Saturdays at 3 p.m. an hour-long spotlight of our local music scene, hosted by me, Malachi Coons. Minnesota Mixtape will continue KAXE's long tradition of uplifting local arts and will highlight the talents of Minnesota musicians by pairing the best new releases with familiar favorites from the past, alongside in-depth artist interviews and exclusive live sessions. Keep on the lookout for other exciting new shows on KAXE in the new year. Our new local music show is Minnesota Mixtape, Fridays at 10 a.m. and Saturdays at 3 p.m. on KAXE, made possible by the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR. From Amazon Business, offering business buying tools and technology with the goal of simplifying how to stock up to get ahead. Learn more at amazonbusiness.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Layla Faldin. Good morning. Since he took office, President Trump has repeatedly suggested that the U.S. should take over Greenland, a territory controlled by Denmark.
It's in a strategic location, and it is rich in critical minerals used in technology. Here's Trump speaking at a cabinet meeting yesterday.
I think Greenland's going to be something that maybe is in our future. I think it's important. It's important from the standpoint of international security.
But leaders in Greenland and Denmark have repeatedly rejected these advances, saying Greenland is not for sale. So an announcement this week that Second Lady Usha Vance is traveling there raised some eyebrows.
NPR White House correspondent Deepa Shivaram joins us now to talk it through. Hey, Deepa.
Hey, good morning.
Okay, so why is Usha Vance going to Greenland? What is she doing?
Right. So spouses of presidents and vice presidents have typically played a role in facilitating some kind of, you know, soft diplomacy. According to the White House, this is a cultural excursion. Vance will visit historical sites, learn about Greenland's heritage, and attend Greenland's national dog sled race, which involves more than 400 dogs, I learned. But given how fraught things are between the U.S. and Greenland, it's an unusual visit for Vance to make. This early in the administration, it's not clear what Vance's portfolio of issues is and what, you know, she'll focus on. But I did talk to a couple people who've studied first and second ladies, and they were surprised at the announcement of this trip because of how contentious the politics are. Here's Elizabeth Natali. She's a professor at UNC Greensboro and helped found the First Ladies Association of Research and Education.
International travel is often set up as a way for first and second ladies to connect with the voting public or the people of the ally often involved in this travel. When you're promoting friendship, you're promoting equality and humanity and democracy. That is not the context at all as she embarks on this trip later this week.
Now, Natali says it's possible that Vance can carve out a space on this trip to convey a positive image of herself and the U.S. She is bringing one of her young sons with her, but combined with the rhetoric from the White House, it might be a steeper climb for the Second Lady.
Now, is she going on her own, or is there more White House involvement here?
So at this point, there's two parts of this. National Security Advisor Mike Waltz is also making a trip to a U.S. military base in Greenland this week. That's separate. And so Vance is traveling with her son and a U.S. delegation, and they'll be there for about 3 days.
And what's the reaction been in Greenland?
It's been negative. In an interview with a Greenlandic newspaper over the weekend, the prime minister of Greenland said that the visit from members of the Trump administration was very aggressive, Layla. He said that Greenland has to face the seriousness of the situation of the U.S. wanting to annex them. Now, Trump, for his part, says this isn't a provocation. He says it's a purely friendly visit and claimed that the U.S. was invited to visit Greenland, though NPR is not able to confirm if there was an invite. He also mentioned that countries like Russia and China are trying to assert more control in the Arctic region. And he teased that Secretary of State Marco Rubio may also visit the territory. And I will just point out that in January, before inauguration, Trump's son, Donald Trump Jr., made a trip to Greenland as well.
That's NPR's Deepa Shivaram. Thank you, Deepa.
Thank you.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin.
Tornadoes, fires, blizzards. We don't like to think about it, but when severe weather hits, how will you stay informed? Hi, I'm Steve Noy, IT and broadcast engineer for KAXE. As an IT professional, it's hard to admit, but in the event of inclement weather, I can't totally count on my phone or internet. As our nation recently realized during the aftermath of Hurricane Sandy or the wildfires in California, weather and power outages can take out essential equipment, creating a dangerous bottleneck as multitudes of requests were routed through backup systems. That's where local radio comes in. Even if every station but one was disabled and every radio within a 50-mile radius was tuned to it, there would be no gridlock, no delays. It doesn't matter how many people are using it. This makes radio a valuable asset, even if the worst should happen, and it's one of the many benefits offered by KAXE. That's why we're looking for your help. Become a member. Text us at 218-326-1234. Be a part of KAXE, people-powered radio.
The noted economist who thinks $120,000 a year is a small price to pay to be sure we're measuring the economy in a cutting-edge way.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Amazon Business, committed to business buying solutions to empower leaders to streamline and focus on growth. Learn more about smart business buying at AmazonBusiness.com.
I'm David Brancaccio in Los Angeles. New Century Advisors chief economist Claudia Somm is the one who came up with a closely watched economic indicator that bears her name, the Somm Rule, Somm, S-A-H-M. She's been writing that it's a mistake for the administration to pull the plug on an obscure volunteer committee of experts that had been meeting once in a while to make sure that economic measures keep up with the times. And she joins us here. Welcome.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Federal Economic Statistics Advisory Committee. Now, this sounds like something an anesthesiologist would use to put you to sleep, but it's the committee is going away, and this is actually keeping you awake.
That's right. There's so much uncertainty about the economy, where we're headed. And it is so important that we have the very best data, the very best statistics on the U.S. economy. And that is no small feat, right? We have a $30 trillion economy. We have 170 million people in the labor force. It's a very dynamic economy, which is super. But that makes it harder to keep the measurement going. And this advisory committee has been in place for many years, and it is a resource to the main economic statistical agencies as a sounding board, as a how could we improve these statistics? What's the best research? And so for me, big picture, we want the best data we can have. And that committee was one resource that we had towards getting those data, and to see that taken away, it's a red flag.
The Commerce Department, under the new Trump administration, says the work of this committee is done, that its mission is, quote, fulfilled. This is not your view.
The work of a committee that is advising on statistics, how to make them more accurate, how to make them more timely, that work will never be finished. In some of the last meetings of the committee, the statistical agencies came to them with questions about how to measure artificial intelligence. I mean, this is a huge question going forward, and we want to be able to have data that represents all kinds of businesses. So the data either keep up or we just don't know what's happening. And then that's a really tricky place for anybody who's trying to make a decision, whether it's a household, a business, the government.
And I think I saw the same statistic as you did. This committee costs like $120,000 a year. Its members are not paid. $120,000 may sound like significant money to somebody, but on the grand scheme of the federal government, it's not an expensive item.
$120,000 to get some outside voices. And these are outside independent voices. They're academics. They're people who work in private sector that have a deep sense of expertise. So it's also about transparency. Like, it's great to have some outside eyes on what's happening in these statistical agencies. So it really shows a very short-sighted view of the economic statistics and the kinds of investments that need to be made in them.
I'm hearing you say that less transparency implied by turning off this committee, less transparency would have its own cost.
Absolutely. We need high quality statistics so that people trust the data. This committee, these are people who are really experts. I mean, just love the nitty gritty of the data. So if something were happening, if the data were being manipulated, they're the kind of experts that would notice. The statistics aren't being manipulated. I'm not saying that's an intention of this administration at all. But having a committee, having outsiders who are knowledgeable about what's happening in the agencies, that's a great way to make sure manipulation doesn't happen, because once you lose trust, it is so hard to gain it back. Like, why would we risk that?
Claudia Somm, chief economist at New Century Advisors, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Dr. Somm came up with a way to track in real time whether we're in a recession. It's about the unemployment rate rising from a low, and you can look it up on a Federal Reserve website, like an electrocardiogram of the economy. Claudia Somm, of Somm Rule fame, are we now in a recession?
We are not in a recession right now.
Taking the marketplace economic pulse, views from a range of perspectives here. Markets Dow and S&P futures are each down 0.1% now. NASDAQ futures are down 0.2%. Now, when news broke yesterday that President Trump might not impose some tariffs on some sectors like the auto industry next week, General Motors stock went up 3.3%. Ford closed up 2.5%. And Tesla, run by the right hand of Trump, Elon Musk, those shares closed up nearly 12%.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Commvault. When companies face ransomware and outages, they can recover data and business in just minutes with Commvault.
The lowest paid workers in America saw the fastest wage growth by far over the last 5 years. That's according to a new report from the Economic Policy Institute. Adjusted for inflation, the bottom 10% of workers saw their pay go up more than 15% between 2019 and 2024. Marketplace's Samantha Fields has more.
This time 5 years ago, between February and April 2020, about 22 million people lost their jobs, many of them low-wage workers.
Workers in leisure and hospitality and retail, right? All of those industries were essentially shut down.
Elise Gould at the Economic Policy Institute says when things reopened and employers started hiring again,
workers had a moment to pause, right? We had one time in history better unemployment insurance programs, and they could be a little bit choosier,
which meant employers had to pay more. This happened across the economy, for those in higher-paying jobs too, just not quite as much. Their wages have risen about 6 or 7% since 2019, compared to 15% for people in the lowest-paying jobs.
It's also 15% starting from a very low base. If you're making $10 an hour, 15% growth is $1.50.
Brad Hirschbein at the W.E. Upjohn Institute for Employment Research says even with that jump in wages, many of the lowest paid workers are still struggling, and inflation has hit them particularly hard.
They tend to buy things that are more subject to inflation, and those things also represent a larger share of all the things that they buy. Take rent, for example. We know that rent is a bigger share of people's budget at the bottom than at the top.
And rent has gone way up in the last 5 years, which he says has eaten into those wage gains. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
Our producers are James Graham, Neil Morrow, Naomi Rainey, Ariana Rosas, Alex Schroeder, and Erica Soderstrom. Our senior producer is Meredith Gerritsen-Morby. In Los Angeles, I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
Coming up in an hour, we bring you local news with the Up North Report.
This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We are People Powered Radio in northern Minnesota. Join us at KAXE.org. Support this morning comes from Paul Bunyan Communications, offering technology for businesses like Smart Biz Managed Voice and Wi-Fi services, security cameras, and more. Online at paulbunyan.net. Paul Bunyan Communications, it's right here. And thanks also goes out to the Northland Foundation. They work within Northeast Minnesota, offering grants, small business supports, and programs to help people and communities, working toward a future where everyone feels they belong.